This podcast is recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge the traditional owners of this country and pay our respects to elders past and present. Welcome to Under One Blue Roof, your podcast exploring the problem of climate-driven homelessness. Here, we ponder some of the big questions about housing, social justice, planetary boundaries, and more, and listen to stories from experts in the field who explain just how it's all related. Let's get to know the human face of climate change.
Hi, and thanks for joining us Under One Blue Roof. I'm your host, Mariska Saldana, a Master of Environment student and social enterprise practitioner. Our episode today is all about technology for good, and I'm delighted to have Mike Davis on the show today. Mike's career spans 14 years working in senior roles in the Victorian Public Service, executive roles in the for-purpose sector, and founding and running his own social impact management consultancy, Purposeful, and podcast Humans of Purpose, which he still runs today. He loves working on solving wicked problems and working with boards and executive teams to drive successful outcomes and social impact. Mike, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you, and I'm really chuffed that you're able to read such a nice introduction of me to me.
Well, it is my pleasure. I had a lot of fun reading up about all of the interesting things you've worked on, from podcasting to consultancy to obviously your work as Head of Strategic Partnerships and Communications at InfoExchange. Incredible organization. How did you get started in the for-purpose world, and what drives you to do good in your work, and how does InfoExchange enable you to start to put into place, you know, all of these ideas and problems and bring it together in such a unique way?
So I just want to first make the point that no careers are actually linear. When we look back at them, they appear, you know, to be maybe in my case a little bit all over the place. Sometimes we look back and it's a logical progression, but as we move through our life course journey and our careers, we make a range of decisions based on where we find our passions and our purpose. And I think that's really sort of important to keep in mind. My career journey, the reason I started out in the public service is that both my parents were public servants, and I just felt a passion to do something to, I suppose, improve society. And I thought public service was the way to do that. I then studied law and found myself as a judge's associate, which I very much enjoyed, but couldn't see myself being a lawyer for the long term. So policy was a convenient place to sort of test ideas and to sort of see what we could do to solve some of the wicked problems that are endemic in society. I wasn't a good fit for government. I sort of discovered that my creativity and my desire to think and do things a bit differently wasn't a good fit for that sort of level of the public service. Don't know how much it's changed, to be fair, but that's a separate thing. But for me, in that space, I decided to work in for-purpose consulting at that time, because around 2016, attention coming to the fore about how to improve society was for-purpose business and for-purpose movements. And I think social enterprise at that time was coming to the fore as well. And I became quite interested in how can business play a role in improving society and social outcomes, but also how do we measure social impact and social outcomes and track that improvement. So that was the journey. And then over time, found myself at InfoExchange, which has been a sort of a logical progression through a few executive roles in the for-purpose sector. Previously had worked in alcohol and other drugs in a small organization that was looking at education, training, counseling, and employment pathways into employment for people experiencing a range of social issues, homelessness being one of them. Actually, InfoExchange was the solution that we used from a technology perspective to do our client and case management. So that was the linkage there. And I just thought, wow, there's a company out there that combines my passions for technology. I'm a huge geek, tech geek, and probably assume that from the podcast and whatnot, but also really passionate about social justice. And I thought, oh, I can't believe there's a place that does both those things. Maybe I should do that. Yeah. And it wasn't that simple to get in, but sometimes when you're intent is in the right place and you're kind of in the right circles, opportunities pop up. One popped up, and here I am.
Incredible. that journey from lawyer to moving into the public service and then, you know, going into strategy and impact roles, I think is a trajectory that a lot of people working in this sector can understand and relate to. Looking at, I guess, the intersection that we have between our understanding of home and what that means to us individually, but also working in a space where homelessness is all around us, and that being a reflection, I guess, of our society and the inherent inequalities and injustices that are so difficult to get to the root of.
Yep.
How do you begin to sort of think through some of those problems? And in particular, I guess, what is your understanding of home and what does it mean to you as a place, as a feeling? What do you think we're striving to get to?
Well, just to address the first part of your question, your point, I mean, I think there are two sorts of people out there. There are those who believe that we don't live in a particularly unequal society, and there are those that do believe that we live in a particularly unequal society. I think the people who care deeply about the space but also look at the data and evidence and take an interest in sort of seeing how things actually are on the ground, plus just the physical reality of walking past people experiencing homelessness regularly in urban and rural centres, can see that we do live in a very unequal society, and perhaps it's becoming more unequal over time, which is scary. And I think the best example of that is the United States, which has just sort of seen its Gini coefficient rise significantly, seeing bigger gaps between the rich and the poor. And this has been a very common theme over the past decade. How do we draw this together as it relates to home? Well, for me, home has always been a place of stability, a place of belonging, a place to really go where I can have the support of family, friends, and a consistent structure to enable me to do what I need to do to economically and socially participate in society. So that's how I think about the importance of home. If I think about what it might be like to not have a home, I just think you're starting off really without a firm base. You're subjecting yourself to a lot of crime, danger, potential abuse, probably exposure to a whole lot of things that are not going to take you on a trajectory to a rich and meaningful life. And it's important to say also that for the vast majority of people that don't have a home or are homeless, it's not a decision or a choice. It's what they might have been born into or what they've experienced up until that point in time. So I think there's very few people who would say, oh, I'm just going to decide to be homeless. So, you know, at that starting point, we're thinking a lot about equity and structural inequity that sort of exists. And we can sort of see that when we look at cities around the world who have done an amazing job at reducing homelessness or getting to functional zero in homelessness, they've adopted a housing first approach to homelessness, which means, like we saw through the pandemic and what the Andrews government did, giving people accommodation who were experiencing homelessness. Unfortunately, after the pandemic ended, they were sort of turfed out, and that was not a successful short-term experiment. But countries that have done it really well and cities that have done it really well have put people experiencing homelessness into stable, well-organized and well-thought-out, sometimes shared accommodation settings that are really good for them and the community that surrounds them, and have given them the opportunity to really, you know, start afresh with that firm base.
Housing first is a really interesting concept, but when you think about it, not all that radical. You know, homelessness is inherently about people having a place to call home and starting from that base, as you said, to give you the right access to opportunities and begin to put down roots and have a solid foundation from which to build the rest of your life. And when you think about stability and what makes society, I guess, in the mainstream kind of functional, it's really having a place to go back to after work or after, you know, you see friends and family, and it's just that place that you come back to and feel safe in. So that's a great approach, and we're seeing some interesting work in Finland where, you know, homelessness has been pretty much eradicated.
Yeah, I think the example of like Finland, Sweden, some of the Scandinavian countries, it doesn't surprise me a great deal. They have incredibly high tax rates. They're able to put all of this money into stunning housing complexes, and probably they didn't have large amounts of homelessness to begin with or rough sleepers. So yes, it's impressive that they've done it. I'm more interested in communities in Canada and the US that are deeply impoverished and had a lot of street homelessness and a lot of out in the open drug use and this kind of thing and violence, and how they've done it has been really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, yeah, you make a great point that isn't it quite logical that the way to end homelessness is to give people homes?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like it's that complex, and there's a reason why Occam's razor will tell us that sometimes the simplest explanation is often the right one. And I think this is a good case in point that, it's not rocket science, is it?
That's right. But the more complexity you have in those social structures and the inequalities that exist and the lack of investment, you know, at an economic level, then it becomes more difficult to put into place those types of solutions, as you said.
I think the other point to make is that homelessness is not just rough sleepers. So there's a lot of people who are moving from home to home or different accommodation to different accommodation. It's a challenge that isn't just about people who are rough sleeping endemically. It can be like across a range of settings. And that's why the Housing First solution can't be the only solution. It's got to be one of a number of approaches. We've also got huge challenges around in societies like ours, like how do we fund that housing? And there are a range of models out there around social housing where there's a huge lack of supply. Obviously, with the housing market being so volatile and there's a lack of supply generally, and that really filters onto the social housing sector and a lack of government and philanthropic investment in creating enough social housing that it's affordable to house people experiencing homelessness. And then, you know, once these people experiencing homelessness are housed, it's also providing the wraparound support services that they need to really thrive. So when you look at other countries that are adopting a housing first approach, they're not just plonking people who have experienced homelessness in houses. There's a range of other things that are happening. There's counselling support, there are case management and caseworkers, there are links into support groups, communities, and all this stuff really matters. You know, that's actually a big part of what we've learned in doing Ask Izzy too.
Yeah, and I want to talk about Ask Izzy in a moment, but I was charting the historical evolution, I guess, of Info Exchange and how it started from this idea of technology for social justice as a platform. And, you know, it was one of the first client and case management systems in Australia that looked at, you know, how do we reduce inequality and allow service providers and agencies to talk to each other and share data and really provide the right supports for people to get back on their feet. And there's been so much outreach work that the organization has done to provide technology to people that need it and organizations that require it to do their work.
Mm-hmm.
So Info Exchange plays this really interesting role, both as an IT service business, but also drives this massive social impact agenda.
Yeah.
Can you explain how your business model enables you to have both commercial success and social impact that supports people and communities facing disadvantage?
Yep. I think at Info Exchange, we run one of the most difficult and challenging business models to run as a not-for-profit social enterprise. Imagine the amount of red tape, regulation, and kind of things that we have to do to be successful, but we're also a commercial IT business. So, you know, like there's a reason that there are very few commercially successful IT businesses that are also social enterprises and not-for-profits. I think it's a credit to our team and the vision of our founder, Andrew Marr, and our current CEO, David Spriggs, and the exec team and those who have gone before, that we've been able to make such a complex model work because we're so committed to that tech for social justice. So I think our byline in our logo really says everything. We are technology and that's our business, but it's for social justice. If you think about what we do, 80% of the revenue that we make comes from our goods and services sold. So those goods and services sold are sold at a discount, and that uplifts the ability of the not-for-profit sector, who are our main clients, to do business more efficiently and effectively. We deliver a huge amount of discounted goods and services such as Google, Microsoft discounts, software discounts, up to 90% in some cases, through validating not-for-profits to access the Connecting Up platform that really enables not-for-profits who have a historically tiny technology spend of around 1% to really save a huge amount of money and therefore serve more people. So the first social impact is around better equipping service providers to run more efficiently and therefore help more of their population or their client service groups. So we have over 40,000 client and case management users, including government and a lot of the not-for-profits in Australia and abroad now. So they are able to use our client and case management tools at a very low market rate to help them serve their clients. They're able to access Connecting Up to help them get all the tools they need to deliver services. They're also able to use the Digital Transformation Hub to help upskill their staff, get training and resources and learning around all the IT challenges an organisation might have. And it's worth mentioning that in a lot of these not-for-profit organisations or social enterprises, there isn't an IT person. There's the CFO, who sometimes can help with IT for a few hours a week. There's an external contractor who's hard to get a hold of. There's a project manager whose partner works in IT, so they know how to do some things. Like, this is the nature of our sector. There isn't enough money to invest in tech, and that's where we come in to sort of make that a lot easier. We also have the largest service directory in the country of not-for-profit services that people can access, service seekers. Over 400,000 community organisations kept up to date, opening hours, contact details, services, key contacts in the country. So I think that's an incredibly valuable resource that we provide to service providers and government. So you'll often see portals through different agencies where they want to direct their communities to services. They're using an API of our service directory platform into their service. So that's that. Ask Izzy has now been accessed by over 15 million people since inception in 2016. We're very lucky to have the support of a range of partners in developing Ask Izzy. It came from a Google Social Impact grant. And then we had the VicGov support. I think we had, let me just make sure I don't forget anyone. We had NAB Foundation, Telstra Foundation, Lord Mayor's, TPG Foundation. So incredibly lucky with all the support we've had to develop that solution. And essentially, Ask Izzy sits on top of the service directory and gives service seekers an easy mobile or website access platform that whatever you need, housing, mental health, domestic violence, funding, financial assistance, could be bills, support with bills and how to pay them. You've got a one-stop solution where people experiencing homelessness or any sort of difficulty can navigate into that system, access and find really easily what they need. You might ask, why is that of value to people experiencing homelessness? Well, a big misconception is that people experiencing homelessness don't have mobile phones and they don't know how to use the internet and they don't know how to do anything because they're so hopeless and homeless. But this is just not true at all. It's a big myth. We know that I think it's around 83% plus of people experiencing homelessness do have mobile phones. So for us, a big part of the solution was getting the Telstra credits so that people can have free data and credits to use the mobile to navigate Ask Izzy. And then the data is also provided too. So we've got this solution where you already had the tool in people who needs its hands, and then giving the credits and the data enables them to actually use and make the most of that service.
Those stereotypes and biases that you just mentioned around what it means to be homeless, yep, I think is really key, because there's so many different ways that someone might find themselves in that situation. Mm-hmm. It's the rough sleepers, as you said. It's also people who are sleeping on a friend's couch or, you know, camping in tents because they can't afford rent, which is exorbitantly high.
Oh, and that's why, you know, our platform today, our number one search request is for food assistance. Mm. It's been our highest month on record for food assistance seekers in February.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it is to do with the housing stress caused by the fast and heavy increases on interest rates. Mortgage repayments are skyrocketing, rents are going up. Food is sort of the first thing that tends to suffer. Mm. So we see that. And it's just also important to make a point that as somebody who's deeply involved with this space, you learn every day about how the platform is being used. I went to the Social Enterprise World Forum in October in Brisbane, one of the best conferences I've ever been to. I was able to speak about the work that we're doing at Info Exchange and with Ask Izzy, and had a number of delegates at that conference who are doing quite well now tell me that they really used Ask Izzy at a time in the past few years and it really helped them. So these are not people who are all rough sleepers, who are destitute and struggling, it's often everyday people like you or me who might have gone through a down period, needed some support in an area, and were able to get that support through AskGizzy and really hearing stories about how that's helped them in certain areas of their life to either escape catch surfing situations or to gain financial independence. Really positive.
Some work that the Big Issue has been doing around bringing into the spotlight this changing face of homelessness. And that's really, I think, just clicked in my head, because what we say often is, you know, it's not any one person or any one thing that causes this. And it can happen to absolutely anyone.
Absolutely.
At any time. And, you know, we think about how we rely on having a stable source of income or, you know, access to the right supports. And if one of those things falls over, then that really can push you into something that you don't think will happen to you, but it can, and that's really scary.
Yeah. Marusha, it's a great point. I often think that even for someone like you or I, we might only ever be one or two big mistakes away from being homeless ourselves. So we should always think about this problem not just as a problem that's distant from us. It's very close to us. We may or may not know people who have experienced homelessness, but we're only ever a few big mistakes away from potentially being in that position ourselves. We've also both, and all of us, in many ways, won the lottery of life, being born into a family where we haven't ended up homeless or started off homeless. So we have to both be grateful about the luck that we've had in being born into the life situation that we have, but also acknowledge that it's a very short road to disaster. And as people, we're not infallible. We all make mistakes. So it can Absolutely. Happen to anyone.
Yeah. And that's part of being human. And I think we sense this community and solidarity in the problems that we see that exist in society, and coming together to work on the right types of approaches at many different levels across multiple industries, you know, organizations and individuals working together to solve this. I think it is doable, and that's what's really exciting. And I know digital inclusion as well is something like homelessness that is a massive issue in Australia. Mm. Can you talk about the nature of that problem and what Info Exchange is doing to tackle it?
Yeah, it's a massive problem. So defining the nature of the problem. So digital inclusion is people being able to access technology and the internet in ways that enable them to actively participate in society, both economically and socially. So imagine not being able to do that because you didn't have the right access to technology. Well, there's probably about 13%, the last data from the Digital Inclusion Index that I think was released the year before the end of last, didn't run last year, said about 13% of Australians were experiencing digital exclusion. So that's 13% of people who just aren't able, because of technology constraints, to participate in society fully. And what might that mean? Well, think about your ability to access essential services. Think about your ability to find a job. Think about your ability to pay your bills. All the basics that really everyone should have in today's modern era just don't happen for a lot of people. And it's got worse anecdotally. And from what we see and what we hear, we think it might be closer to 20% of Australians actually being digitally excluded. Now, the new government is doing a fair bit. They're doing some interesting things around particularly First Nations people getting access to more digital services, and we welcome that. But there is a long way to go, and we know that digital exclusion disproportionately affects people living in remote and regional communities, First Nations people, people who are already living below the poverty line, called communities. So it's actually sort of a double impact. You've got people who are already disadvantaged, further disadvantaged by their lack of digital access.
Yeah, and I was thinking about the recent wave of extreme weather that we've had in Australia, from the bushfires to the floods to heat waves, and, you know, it's cyclic, so we can just expect it's going to continue happening at this alarming rate. In terms of how technology is accessible and affordable for people who are coming out of those times of disaster, have you noticed anything from the work that you're doing in how that actually plays out in reality, and what happens I guess, on the ground or at that service provider level, is it pure chaos or is there just some sort of loose organization that we can hope is happening? Because as someone who hasn't necessarily been in the middle of that, I'm just wondering, how do people get help? How do people recover?
Yeah, so I suppose I can give you a couple of answers or responses that might help look at that problem. So InfoExchange has been involved in helping to develop disaster relief portals for various state governments and organisations working in affected areas. So for the floods, for example, in New South Wales and, the wild weather events we've been seeing around the country, we have been contracted at times to portal in access to the service directory and, you know, guide people to disaster relief services in particular. So that's one way we try and help address the problem. It's not our raison d'etre. It's not why we exist as an organisation, but it's a problem we acknowledge we can help solve through our technology. The other thing to say is that, yes, frontline workers and people working in not-for-profit organisations that are largely responsible for coordinating disaster relief efforts are facing stress, facing overwork, being more stretched than they ever have been. I don't have the numbers in my head, but there was a recent ACOS report that was released a few months ago speaking to the struggle that frontline workers and not-for-profit sector workers are facing in responding to the really higher than ever demands across a range of fronts, but also disaster relief. Certainly there is strain there. Technology can play a role in helping to make disaster response organisations and staff more efficient and effective through technology. But there's also needs to be more investment and support for those organisations and particularly their employees who can experience a lot of burnout in the same way that a lot of mental health counsellors experience that sort of vicarious, I think they call it empathy burnout, where your life becomes really hard because, you know, you kind of absorb a lot of the stress that you're seeing from the people you're helping.
Yeah, that is a very real part of any kind of work in social services or not-for-profit. It's hard to separate what's happening with your program participants and your clients and, you know, the communities that you exist to serve and how you can actually perform within your role and your job and still, you know, manage to do what needs to be done at the end of the day. It's incredibly difficult to look after yourself and take care of your mental health.
Yeah, and I think that's an area that we are underdeveloped in as a society, is how do we support those doing the hardest frontline work that requires a lot of empathy and emotion and support. The health of those people is absolutely vital, and we need to be doing more to support them, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. You talked a little bit about how not-for-profits have a comparatively small budget to fund their IT and tech departments. And given the critical nature of the work that not-for-profits do in our communities, what can not-for-profits be doing perhaps to get started on their digital transformation journey?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. When we talk about digital transformation, often you hear innovators talking about things like AI and everyone needs AI and ChatGPT and all this guff. And yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I don't think it's well known, but a lot of not-for-profits that use technology also have AI things and functions that are used in their organisations. But we release an annual tech report that looks at the needs of 650 approximate not-for-profit organisations in the sector, their digital needs for that year. And you might be surprised to know that, you know, 44% say that they're updating their website is their main priority. So, you know, this probably gives you a sense of the lack of funding and support and capability in these organisations by and large. So it's not – digital transformation is something that we support through the Digital Transformation Hub, cloud migration, some of the more, I would say, advanced stuff, cybersecurity as well, becoming more and more important for not-for-profits. But the needs of not-for-profits from what we've seen – are really around things like having a good, robust website, having a well-functioning CRM or client and case management system, having systems that enable them to take appropriate action but also measure impact and outcomes is vital. So they're kind of the core needs that we look at, and then also the training of the people in those organisations. So digital skills, cybersecurity as well being more important, and we do a bit of that through the Digital Transformation Hub as well. And also important to note that there is an expert bar as part of the Digital Transformation Hub where if you're any sort of not-for-profit and you have a question, It's like an Apple store where you walk in and you say, I've got problems, help me. It's manned by a range of volunteers who are very capable and our staff. And if you've got any IT problem, you can just jump on the Digital Transformation Hub and ask a question at free of charge. Not many services out there like that.
That's so true. And there's always, you know, Google is incredibly helpful when it comes to how do I do this thing? But having a place that you can go to sort of get all of those answers from real people, yeah. I guess, is good because, yeah, there's just so many things that not-for-profits have to do that technology becomes, you know, the enabler but also
the barrier in some senses.
Yeah.
Particularly where there's a lack of investment and capability in the organisation. Mm. And so we're working on both of those things. You know, even at InfoExchange, everything that we do, we have a product advisory group full of people with lived experience in homelessness from diverse communities. We have a disability reference group. We're deeply consultative and adopt co-design practices in rolling out any of the technology that we do.
Mm.
We can't solve human problems just through technology.
Yeah, that's key. It's really the people around the table, I think, that guide the right developments and iterations. And technology is only as good as the people that are behind it.
Yep.
And when you're thinking about groups within the community that need to have a say, it is incredibly important to be talking to the right people and inviting them to be a part of the journey.
Absolutely. I think technology solutions are only as good as the people who are going to be using those solutions, appropriately co-designing and consulted as part of that process. Without that, you've got nothing useful.
To wrap up our conversation, I thought I'd ask you a question that I ask each of my guests, which is what your vision is for a sustainable and equitable climate future and what kinds of technology we might need to fill these gaps in society where inequality and injustice lives?
That's a massive question, multidimensional. And look, to be fair, we do have a climate action group at InfoExchange that's working on various things. We're deeply involved in carbon credits to offset what we do. As an organisation, we're carbon neutral in how we operate because of that carbon credit scheme. So I think we could see a lot more of that happening. But I think it's also just, I think we have now a clear understanding that if we don't take action, deliberate action soon, we're going to be in even worse climate crisis than we are now, and things are getting worse, not better, right? So the message has finally landed. It's taken a while. I think the Teal campaign did a lot for that in Climate 200. So definitely shout out to them for their work. But it's now about behaviour change. So that's the hardest thing to do. It's not changing people's attitudes or beliefs. It's getting that belief to link up to the behaviour change. So we see things that are becoming more and more prevalent, like you and I are both using reusable coffee cups, which is good. How much difference does it make? It's more probably symbolic than it is actually making an enormous difference. But then there are a few extensions from that that do make a big difference. We're seeing like a lot of people no longer using disposable water bottles. We're seeing people deciding to look at on all the products they purchase, the carbon impact that they're having and, you know, how renewable or organic they are and for laundry purposes and whatnot. These are big changes. People are considering what is the most sustainable power company to go with. So I think this chain of beliefs, attitudes and behaviours is slowly linking up. What more can technology do to help that? Probably when I think about that, it's about giving people easy ways to make changes to their lives that make a difference. I've sort of come to the conclusion that it's not government that's going to drive this. It's not philanthropy that it's going to drive this. We as the people have to drive this ourselves. And if you believe that we are heading towards climate emergency or disaster, you've got a responsibility to take action yourself. And so what I like are mobile app solutions that can help you make better decisions. I want to just shout out One Small Step is a really good, are you familiar with that app?
I don't think I am, no.
So Lily Dempster is the creator of that app and was on my podcast recently. And she's released an app that basically goes through every product and service category and can tell you like what's good and what's not for climate.
Cool. Sounds great.
So highly recommend anyone listening checks that out. And then we recently had on the podcast Eve France, who's doing amazing work in sustainability for offices and homes. And she's just like this walking bank of information around what we could be doing better. Like, she's a person who spends all her time thinking about what is my environmental impact right now and how could it be less.
Yeah.
And we need people like that around us.
I was listening to that one this morning actually on the way here.
She's just a wealth of information.
There's so many changes that you can make to your daily life that just makes a huge positive impact.
Yeah, and I think like there are easy things. I mean, for me, fashion has been a thing. So now I mainly buy Allbirds because they are, you know, far less carbon impact and much better for the environment. I will try and reuse and wear clothing for as long as possible without replacing it. There are just simple things we can do. For our son, Marlo, my wife, Louise, rather than going out and buying expensive new crap, just goes on Facebook Marketplace and sees who wants to give away stuff and upcycle things. So yeah. There's so many things we can be doing. Don't even get me started on coffee and other things. But, you know, like there's a lot happening out there. There is not enough. There needs more investment for that kind of thing. But as we start to see consumer preferences change and also more venture capital investment going into companies, we're going to see a lot more change, and that's exciting.
This purpose-driven economy that we're in now and moving towards is really that sort of critical juncture, I think, because people are starting to make space for decisions and actions that are good for the environment, that are good for people. And it's a lot easier to do than you would think. And the role the technology is playing in that is super exciting. So
yeah,
thank you.
My pleasure. I'm very excited about the future and I'm excited about the role that technology can play. But it's not just technology, it's people also.